be able to join together in this and just keep thinking about Mike off and on throughout the week. The more we immerse ourselves in the study of a book in the Bible, the more we love it, and the more we gain from it, and the more we grow from it. Let's have a prayer before we start. Joel, would you lead us in prayer?
Dear God, we come up with you. Thank you for this time that we can study your word. We thank you for the prophet Micah. We ask that you be with us in this class. Help us to learn all that we can about Micah, your prophet. Please give us your Gary as he teaches us. And we say prayer. Amen.
All right, so we were looking at Micah 4, verses 6 and 7. In that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcasts, even those whom I have afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant, and the outcast a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever. There is a glorious future for the remnant of God's people, and he's giving hope. Now, it's not for all of God's people. It's for the remnant. The remnant is the faithful few that have been purged and purified through the judgments and the sufferings. But for them, there's going to be a wonderful future as God gathers these lame, outcast, afflicted ones together and reigns over them forevermore. Ties back into the promise to David, 2 Samuel 7, 1 Chronicles 17, that one of his descendants essentially would establish an everlasting kingdom. Now look at verse 8. As for you, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come. Even the former dominion will come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Now that's a little complicated way of saying that, but when he talks about that to God's people will come, the former dominion, what does he have in mind, the former dominion?
Former glory.
The former glory. What was the former glory? When was that?
Solomon.
Maybe not even so much Solomon as
David.
Think about some passages that would tie into this. I'm thinking about Isaiah 9. Remember this passage in Isaiah 9, 6, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. There was going to be a great child who was going to be the eternal father who would reign on the throne of David to establish justice and righteousness forevermore. Look at Hosea chapter 3. Hosea chapter 3, you have a similar thing. Afterward, verse 5, afterward the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. This is long after David, but he's predicting the return of David, their king. Or especially a passage that's cited in Acts, Amos chapter 9. Cited in Acts 15, but Amos chapter 9. And I can get my pages apart. Verse 11. In that day I will raise up the fallen booth of David. The booth of David had fallen. What does that mean? You know, what does it mean the booth of David had fallen? Yes, David's lineage, David's dynasty as king had fallen. Ben?
The New King James has tabernacle.
Yes, yes. The same idea. It's his rulership. When they went into Babylonian captivity, there was no more Davidic lineage on the throne, right? And then that was reestablished by Jesus. He took over and was reigning on the throne of David, only in a much greater sense. The former glory returned and then some. So I think the idea of Hosea 4:8 is the idea of the former dominion coming, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem, is this idea of God's giving the kingship back to David's lineage in Jesus. Was Jesus a descendant of David? Yeah, he was the son of David, not father, son, but he was descendant, and so he was reestablishing this Davidic rule, only a much greater and more glorious way. This is more than the kingdom of David ever thought about being when he established that eternal kingship. Thoughts and comments to verse 8. Okay. All right, would somebody read 9 and 10?
Now, why do you cry aloud? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished, that pain sees you like a woman in labor? Rise, and groan, O daughter Zion, like a woman in labor. For now you shall go out from the city and dwell in the open country. You shall go to Babylon. There you shall be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies.
Now, we've got a lot of the now and then sections over these next few verses. Because now it looks bleak. God is promising judgment, destruction, the end of the Davidic lineage. But then there will be great blessings as God restores the former dominion and the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. So now, why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you? So he's looking forward to the time when there will be no king, when the Babylonians have conquered. And do you remember who the last king of Judah was? Zedekiah. Was Zedekiah in the lineage of Jesus? No. Who was the last king in the lineage of Jesus?
Jehoiachin,
exactly. Very good. Jehoiachin, Jeconiah. And so really, when they deposed Jeconiah, remember what they did, or Jehoiachin, same guy. Remember what happened to him? You know, Luke, what happened to him?
Taken into captivity and chains, I know that. I know Zedekiah, who was blinded after seeing something, but I don't recall.
Yeah, he was taken to Babylon. Yeah, he was taken to Babylon. After 37 years, if I'm not mistaken, he was released in Babylon and all that. But he was really the one that ended the Davidic lineage, because Zedekiah was an uncle of Jeconiah's, but was not in the lineage of the Messiah. How did they feel in this terrible situation? What does he describe this like?
Childbearing.
Yeah. Any of you ever born a child? Guess you're probably not the right gender for that. A few of us have been with our wives when they've born children. You heard anything about labor pains, guys? What do you hear about it?
It's almost as bad as my man has a headache.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I mean, it's bad. And, you know, just kind of proverbially bad. Here's something that the Bible does a lot. This labor pain idea of great, terrible suffering is a common metaphor, a common way of describing some terribly painful circumstance, but usually with the idea that what comes from labor pains?
A child.
Now, how does a mother feel about having a child? Yeah, so it's kind of the pains that are excruciating that lead to a wonderful outcome. That's what he's saying here. You know, writhe and labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. For now you will go out of the city, dwell in the field, and go to Babylon. This is the terrible labor pains. They're suffering greatly as they're sent into exile, sent out to Babylon. This is painful. This is, you know, grief and all that, agony. But there, what happens, does he say in verse 10? There, but after the labor there, you'll be rescued. You will be redeemed from the hand of your enemies. God's going to bring good out of that. The suffering is the door of hope. Remember, the valley of Achor is the door of hope. The suffering they passed through, the Babylonian exile, purged out a remnant that ultimately were blessed by being brought out of Babylon, out of exile, and ultimately out of the bondage that Babylon symbolized, which is the bondage to sin, Satan, and death. And that's the greater deliverance that passing through these pains of childbirth were going to bring them. Thoughts and comments? Carl?
Direct parallel to what happens in Genesis 3, it's passing through the pains of childbearing to save the baby.
Yes.
This idea is really impregnated from Genesis 3.
Right, yes. Yeah, good point. Yeah, Genesis 3 has that same same idea, and really, it's through the childbearing, literally, that the Messiah comes into the world, remarkably. Good thought. Other comments? Okay, would somebody read 11 to 13?
Now many nations are assembled against you, saying, let her be defiled, let our eyes not gaze upon Zion. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his plan, that he has gathered them as sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughters of Zion, for I will make you your horn iron, and I will make your hoofs bronze. You shall be eaten in pieces many people, and shall devote their grain to the Lord, their wealth to the lords of the whole earth.
Okay, what do you see happening in verse 11? Yeah, all these nations come together. Notice this is another and now. Here's the before and after. Here's the now part, and then there's going to be the then part. Now many nations have assembled against you. What are they assembled to do?
Well, they're against Israel.
They're against Israel. What are they wanting to do? They're wanting to disgrace them. Gloat over them. They're wanting to destroy God's people. Have you ever noticed that those who are against the Lord seem to have an extreme compulsion to destroy the people of God? You know, you could see them just being indifferent. Well, you know, whatever. I'm not going to pay any attention to them. But they seem to go farther than that. How many times have the people who aren't with the Lord really wanted to destroy God's people? Can you explain why?
Kind of like they have an almost victory over God in their minds.
Yes. And almost a need to destroy everything that's good and everything that rebukes them. They almost have a perverse delight in the downfall of God's people. They have gathered together to gloat over Zion. They're licking their chops. They've got Zion. They're going to bring her down. And they're going to enjoy her demise. Now, is this the first time in this chapter that we've read of many nations coming?
No.
When did we read of it earlier?
Before, when they go to the mountain.
Yeah, all those nations, many nations coming up to the mountain. But now these many nations are coming up to the Lord's people to destroy them. And did Babylon destroy Jerusalem? Yeah. Did they take the people into exile? Yeah. But, verse 12, they do not know the thoughts of the Lord, and they do not understand his purpose. Isn't that the way that usually works? The wicked people never realize what God's really up to. And so what they end up doing is very counterproductive to what they want to accomplish. It turns out to boomerang against them. Have you noticed how Satan has a habit of doing that? Can you think of any time Satan has done something that really turned out to be really stupid from his goal? That turned out to destroy him instead of help him?
Jesus.
Yeah! Boy, he thought he had him there, killed him dead. How did that work out for Satan? Killed him dead. But in the process,
his people, God's people have hope.
Yeah, he provided for the atonement that rescued people out of his dominion, out of his slavery. He lost big time. Reminds me of 1 Corinthians 2. Do you know this passage in 1 Corinthians 2? This is a cool passage. Talking about the contrast between the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God. And he says in, for example, in 1 Corinthians 2:6, we do speak wisdom. Now, it's not worldly wisdom, but we got wisdom. And he says, we speak God's wisdom, verse 7, in a mystery. The hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory. The wisdom, verse 8, which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. If they had understood what the Lord was up to, they would have never furthered his cause by crucifying the Messiah and causing his blood to be shed to rescue everybody from their sins. They didn't intend to do that. They would never have helped out God's plan, but they didn't know what it was. They didn't understand. And so they ended up doing the very opposite thing of what they wanted to accomplish. Same thing here. These guys have come together against God's people, but they don't know the thoughts of the Lord. They don't understand his purpose. They don't realize what's going on. They are unwitting tools of their own destruction. It's all part of God's plan. So really, when they come together to fight against Jerusalem, how does God view that in the end of verse 12? Who really brought them together? God did, as she, like sheaves to the threshing floor. You just have a hard time understanding a passage like this without analyzing every word. Sheaves to a threshing floor. What's a sheaf? A bundle of wheat. What's a threshing floor?
Beat the wheat to separate.
Yes. You know anything about wheat? It's so bad that, you know, I don't have any farming background anymore. Do you know what wheat grows on? Have you seen wheat? What? There's two parts to wheat. What are the two parts? The straw and like the grain in that head. Now, which is the part you want? The grain. The straw is really not worth anything. And do you understand that if you took a straw, what happens if you throw straw up in the air? It just blows away. It's so light, it has no substance. But those grains are much more dense. So what they do, they take them to a great big threshing floor. They'd actually, a lot of times, use an animal like an ox to trample the wheat. And as he walked around on the wheat, it would rub those grains off the straw, or people could stomp on it and do the same thing. And then you get a little bit of breeze, take a big scoop shovel, and just throw that up in the air. What happens to the straw? And what happens to the grain? Yeah. So the idea is a judgment figure. God takes the straw, blows it away and gathers it up and burns it, and he takes the grain, his true people, into the barn and preserves them and blesses them. So God actually gathered these nations together. They thought they were gathering to destroy God's people, but God was gathering them like sheaves to the threshing floor. They were being brought together to be separated, to be punished, and for God to make the division between the wheat and the chaff. Arise and thresh, daughter of Zion. For your horn I will make iron, and your hooves I will make bronze, that you may pulverize many peoples. Now, he's describing God's people as a what? As an ox or some kind of a animal. And I'll make your horn iron. When you talk about the horn of an animal, what does a horn represent to an animal? Yeah, it's the strength of the animal, right? Would iron make it stronger or weaker? Stronger, powerful. And he makes their hooves bronze. Now, the idea is they're going to be threshing this wheat, these nations that have come, with bronze hooves. They're pulverizing them. So God is using his people to destroy these wicked people who come against them. and devoting to the Lord their unjust gain and their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. So the wicked are destroyed and their wealth is devoted to God. So you've got that now and then. Now the nations assemble to destroy God's people, but ultimately then they're going to assemble to be thrashed by God's people and to be pulverized and destroyed. So the idea of these passages in Micah is the idea that right now the God's people are going to be punished. They're going to be destroyed, sent into captivity, sent into Babylon, end of the Davidic line and all that. But then God will take the remnant and bless them again. The former dominion of David will be restored. God's people will be strong and destroy their enemies. That's a lot to go through to get that. It's very picturesque. It makes you think. You don't quickly forget those pictures. So let me pause and what questions and comments do you have? Reagan. Yeah. Realize God's really young. He is not unnerved by the strength of his enemies. You ever arm wrestle a little kid? How do you arm wrestle a little kid? Do you ever let him kind of get the upper hand and kind of start to bring your hand down toward the mat? Yeah, you don't have to worry about it. Whenever you want to, you boom, and it's over. Now, what if you arm wrestle somebody who's maybe even a little stronger than you are? You play around with them like that? No, you try to get the jump on them, right? God can toy with these. The moment he exhales a little hard, they'll be gone. You know, God is so powerful that he's never threatened by his enemies. He just uses his enemies to accomplish his purpose. Other thoughts? All right, we're going to stop here for tonight. Who's got their hand up? Somebody does. Oh, Justin.
Just point here in the 13. He's doing this to comfort his people, but also to bring glory to himself and describes the pushing of the wealth.
Good point. Yeah, good point. So we're going to pause here, and got several things going on tonight, so we've got plenty of time for Micah over these next couple of days. Got 3 more chapters left and 4 more lessons to do those in, so I don't think that'll be any problem. So Joe's will take over from here.
We'll take about 5 or 10 minutes, use the bathroom, get a drink if you need to, and then we'll have the evangelism talk.